Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, the North Carolina A&T Jazz Ensemble All-Stars are live in Studio A with an insider's look at this great improvisational art form. Then, it was 1 year ago today that Junebug writer, filmmaker, Winston-Salem native, and UNCSA alumnus Angus McLaughlin finished shooting his latest feature-length film right here in the Triad. It's called Goodbye to All That, but as you'll hear behind the scenes with Angus, this movie screams Hello, School of the Arts. Next, we head straight to the border. Faith Action House's David Fracaro is here with his colleague Andy Mendez. As a girl, Andy crossed the border with her family 13 years ago. Now she has a U.S. citizen child, and she'll share her perspective on immigration during Faith Action's production of Out of the Shadows. We conclude with a border of a different sort, a no man's land between two World War I trenches in Europe and the unlikely truce that took place there during Christmas of 1914. Cantus Vocal Ensemble brings that astounding historical moment to life for us after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. For some people, jazz music is something to listen to occasionally, collect, and share with friends. For others, it's a way of life, a constant search for that perfect melody. Trumpeter Mondre Moffett continues his search, which began as a young boy. Mondre's father was a legendary avant-garde or free jazz drummer, Charles Moffett. Mondre grew up performing trumpet and composing for the Moffett Family Jazz Band, touring the U.S. and Southeast Asia, and later internationally with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Today, Mondre brings his wealth of jazz knowledge to bear at North Carolina A&T State University, where he teaches composition, arranging, jazz history, gospel history, and black music in America. He also directs the A&T Jazz Ensemble All-Stars. They'll perform a concert on Thursday night, November 21st at 7 o'clock in Harrison Auditorium on the A&T campus in Greensboro. It's titled Jazz Music, A Global Expression. Mondre and his outstanding young all-stars are here with a sneak preview live in Studio A. Pianist Marcus Tung, Byron Carter on bass, drummer Isaac Cusar, Johnny Jackson on alto sax, and guitarist Lawrence Thompson. They kick things off with a Rodgers and Hart classic that's become a jazz ballad standard, My Funny Valentine. Thank you. a Rodgers and Hart classic to start things off. My Funny Valentine, very funky Valentine, and a great arrangement. How did this arrangement come about?
Well, My Funny Valentine, a jazz standard. We just want to put a groove on it, you know? We just want to put some stank on it, something different from what we've been doing, kind of thinking of a global expression and, you know, dealing with jazz from that standpoint.
Yeah.
And it just evolved over time.
Was that a rhythm section beginning? How did the first little tweak begin?
I think they had this little lick that comes up in between that we played off of.
Yeah.
And then I noticed Johnny was real comfortable, our alto saxophone player, in that groove. It just kind of reminded me of Grover Washington. And it's good to start off with it because it really gets us kind of locked into a groove. And I thought it would be a good thing to start most concerts with.
And for most folks, a great recognizable tune, Rodgers and Hart. It's interesting to me that Rodgers and Hart, so many of their tunes have become, and they're all over the real book. They're jazz standards now. What is it about their music that lends itself so well to jazz?
All I know is that you have jazz standards and you have jazz originals. Rodgers and Hart, they really produce a lot of jazz standards that went into Broadway shows. I love the tune because I heard Miles Davis do it live at Plug Nickel. He and Herbie Hancock, I think Wayne Shorter, Tony Williams. The best record Miles Davis ever made. Since that was made in such a classic, I said, okay, My Funny Valentine has to go another way now. Because after hearing Miles play that record, play it so beautifully as a ballad, you know, it's been done that way.
Yeah.
And so
I was going to ask some of the guys in the band, I guess I'll start with Johnny. Who are some of your saxophone idols growing up? And how'd you get into playing the sax in the first place?
My parents, they purchased me a saxophone in fifth grade.
Fifth grade? Okay.
Yeah. And Charlie Parker and Kenny Garrett, Grover Washington Jr., some of those saxophone players are and still are the people that I listen to.
Yeah. I'm hearing beautiful colors from all those different sounds in your sound, but it's your own thing. Talk about that, just finding your own voice on the instrument.
Yes, I really want to be able to play with a world music concept on my instrument. I want to be able to sound great on many different styles of jazz. Mm. I want to be able to play from Latin to swing to bebop. I want to have a really wonderful sound.
That's why we study. That's why we go to this great school. I should say that for listeners not in the know, you come from an extremely musical family, one of the musical dynasties out there in the world of jazz and beyond. And that whole teacher-student relationship within the dynamic of the family. Well, give me a core, if you would, because you're, you know, in addition to being a fantastic performer, a wonderful teacher, wonderful educator, what did you gather from your father in terms of that dynamic? And I know there are probably hundreds of things that come to mind, but like at the core, what did he give you?
First of all, just music is fun. And don't be afraid of any music. I mean, just really be free and do it. Learn by doing. But he just gave me a wonderful legacy. I mean, and all the cats were always over, you know, Art Blakey and all of his friends, all the drummer friends. Max Roach is the godfather, my younger brother. And Arnett Coleman is my goddad. And he and best man at my mom and dad's wedding. And I would just sit at their feet and listen to those guys talk. The first thing attracted to me to the music was to see the love between them. And I would just sit and just listen. But when it was time to play music, it was fun. But there was a very much a seriousness to the approach.
Mm.
And that's one of the things in the music students who know me, they know that when it's time to make some music, you know, you have to play it like it's your last time.
Byron, our bass player here, playing jazz music and learning all this is not the easiest thing in the world you could be doing right now. Why do you make that kind of commitment to rise to those sorts of levels?
Because many of the people who aspire to be like playing bass had a background in jazz, and I kind of grew up on it. It was in my house being played. The schools I went to heavily encouraged jazz from elementary school all the way through high school and now college.
You got some amazing facility on your instrument. What kind of commitment are we talking about to get that agile at what you do? Could you talk me through a typical day in terms of practice hours, rehearsal, and what kind of investment you need to make in your instrument to make it sing at that level?
I started playing when I was about 10 or 11 years old. So when I first started, I would go in my basement or a shed, so to speak, and I used to have 3 or 4 CDs that I would play over and over, like a gospel CD, an R&B CD, a jazz CD, different genres. Mm. And I would try to perfect those CDs and different styles. And then when I got those down, I would pull some more out and try those. And I did that for maybe 3 or 4 years until I could actually come out and be able to play by ear and somewhat read and be able to play a lot of different genres of music.
That seems like a real standard learning tool, playing with recordings. I heard of Branford Marsalis talking about having giant steps on his turntable for 2 years, you know, until he had pretty much memorized it. And what do you pick up from that experience? What sorts of things get into you as a musician from repeated listening and that sort of thing?
Repeated listening, it just trains your ear. Mm. It trains you, and if you're playing along with it, it trains your body to be able to move with the music. And you, especially when you're on your instrument, to know where, how to get different feels and know where your notes and your pitches and all that stuff is. So.
All right. And we get to put it to the test now with some Moaning. And let's hear some Art Blakey. This is a great tune, a great groove tune, and you all really make it your own. So this is North Carolina A&T Jazz Ensemble All-Stars, and they're live in Studio Way. We're going to hear Moaning next, and we've got Mr. Marcus Tung on piano, Byron Carter bass guitar, Isaac Cousar on drums, Johnny Jackson on alto sax, and on guitar, Mr. Lawrence Thompson. This is Moaning. Thank you. besides Monin, which he did do when he played the drums a lot, but the late, great Art Blakey, what did he bring to the table?
Oh, man. Art was such a charismatic figure. It's just so hard to be a leader in the field of jazz because you have such strong personalities. But he was one that, you know, he led by example. He didn't try to say, okay, this is a quarter note or this is a half note. He's like, okay, you'll get it right in a minute. Or, hey, you have to tell a story. Or you need to play with more fire. And I'm kind of imitating his voice. I'm going to take you to New York. Not take you to New York. When you coming to New York? You say, well, Art, you know, I'm going to get there any way you can, you know. Just a wonderful, wonderful individual.
Marcus, I was wondering how you go about finding your strengths and growing within what you have, your tools, and where are you in that whole process in learning about jazz playing?
I haven't been playing real long. I've been playing for about 2 years.
Wow.
But I'm fortunate to know my piano theory. Theory helps me a lot. Listening to the different guys like Oscar Peterson and Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington with the jazz era, that helps me to try to find my own way and my own different sound from everybody else. I take a little bit from everybody, from, well, those three mainly, because those guys are...
There's plenty to work with.
They're the bomb. I take a little bit from those three and just come up with my own stuff, and that's how I try to make my sound.
We'll be right back. That was Hannibal by the late, great Miles Davis, performed by the North Carolina A&T Jazz Ensemble All-Stars, led by director and acclaimed jazz trumpeter Mr. Mondre Moffett. We heard pianist Marcus Tung, Byron Carter on bass, drummer Isaac Cusar. On alto, we heard Johnny Jackson and guitarist Lawrence Thompson. Together, they'll perform a concert on Thursday night, November 21st at 7 o'clock in Harrison Auditorium on the A&T campus in Greensboro. It's titled Jazz Music, A Global Expression. Tickets are just $10, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to jump behind the scenes with writer, actor, filmmaker, and director Angus McLaughlin.
1 year ago, we shot a movie that I wrote called Goodbye to All That here in Winston-Salem. My name is Angus McLaughlin, and I'm a native of Winston, and I graduated from the North Carolina School of the Arts. Epoch Films, who produced Junebug, is a company out of New York, but I have so many people ask me, did you use local talent? And I tell them that we had a casting agent in L.A., and I went to L.A. and New York to see actors, and we ended up with Paul Schneider and Heather Graham and Amy Sedaris and Anna Camp, Melanie Linsky, and a child actor who was originally from Houston, Texas. But we did use local talent because we also had a local casting person, and we had a line producer, Summer Shelton, who grew up in Mount Airy and also attended the North Carolina School of the Arts. I had known that Paul Schneider, our lead, graduated from the School of the Arts Film School as an editor. He fell into acting when David Gordon Green, who was a fellow classmate, cast him in two of his films. I had also gotten Beth Bostick, who was in school with me, and she played a small role in the film. Celia Weston, who played the mother in Junebug, also has a role in the film, and she is a graduate of both Salem College and the North Carolina School of the Arts. And I had gotten two of my classmates, one who lives in Atlanta and one who lives in New York, also came and did two small roles in the film. I was talking to our makeup woman, who we had hired from L.A., and she said, yeah, you know, I went to the School of the Arts in high school as a flutist. And so I started to think, this is, you know, interesting and intriguing. And I finally asked Summer Shelton, our line producer, after we had wrapped up, to give me a list of how many School of the Arts alumni were involved in our little film. And she compiled a list, and it turned out that we had 38 School of the Arts alumni working on our film in every capacity, and not just from the film school. There were people like myself who graduated in high school from visual arts and from the drama department. There were other drama department graduates. There was the music department. There were D&P department, that's design and production, who worked in the art department on our film. And I thought that this was interesting and says something not only about the film school, but about the infiltration of the entire School of the Arts into showbiz, because none of these people were hired because they were graduates. There was a discovery after the fact. There's something about the school that I think its size, its intensity, its rigor, that makes you feel as if you're part of a family. And so it was great in my experience on my first film, shooting in my hometown, that I got to involve people that are part of my family because I am a School of the Arts graduate. I remember when I first graduated, I went to New York, and another graduate and I were walking down the street, and we saw Tommy Hulse, who played Mozart in the film Amadeus. And at that time, he was doing a lot of theater. He hadn't done Amadeus yet. And we just went right up to him and said, we're from the School of the Arts, and we know you went to the School of the Arts. And he could not have been nicer. He was kind. He was not condescending. He took us as peers. And I always think of that when people either come to me or now work with me on a project, to try to do the same thing, because you really do feel like you've all gone through this boot camp, kind of like the Marine Corps, and you all know what that's like. So there was a great feeling of, I don't know how to put it, camaraderie or using local talent. We used local talent. They just don't all happen to live here.
Behind the Scenes with writer, actor, filmmaker, and director of the new film Goodbye to All That, Angus McLaughlin. The movie was filmed in Winston-Salem. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from this short break, with all the sad news out there, couldn't we all use just a few stories of hope and courage? Well, Faith Action International House in Greensboro is here to lift our spirits, and world-renowned male vocal ensemble Cantus will pick up the torch of tolerance as well. Come out of the shadows, where all is calm, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got two of the best vocalists in the male vocal ensemble business right here with Cantus just about 10 minutes from now. But before we get there, we'll need to emerge from out of the shadows. Out of the Shadows, stories of hope and courage from our newest immigrant neighbors, is Faith Action International House's theatrical performance of gripping tales of assimilation as told by local immigrants. They'll be accompanied by songs about the immigrant experience and surrounded by beautiful photographic portraits by Todd Drake. Faith Action's David Fricaro and Andy Mendez stop by to talk about it.
Brother still sleepy, grumbles, it's not light yet. If you want a new life, what's a few minutes away?
What's the mission of Faith Action International House, David?
Faith Action serves thousands of new immigrants each year, while also educating and connecting our diverse community across lines of culture and faith, turning strangers into neighbors.
I like that phrase, turning strangers into neighbors. Well, arts is a big part of Faith Action International. I mean, the music, a universal language, what have you, but Out of the Shadows, stories of courage and hope from our newest immigrant neighbors. What was the genesis of this production?
Well, in the midst of this tremendous new diversity in our community, again, it's no longer happening just in huge cities like New York, L.A., or Chicago, but increasingly this tremendous new influx of immigrants is happening in places like Omaha, Dayton, and Greensboro. And at Faith Action, we essentially say our community has a choice to make. Are we going to fear one another as strangers or embrace one another as neighbors? And so how do you go about truly turning a stranger into a neighbor without it just being some kind of a hokey tagline? And it really starts with education, so people aren't dealing with myths about people, but facts. And they're also dealing face-to-face with someone who is a new immigrant, and they're listening to their stories. Thankfully, we have the arts to help tell those stories. And so what we've done is we've taken 10 stories from folks that we've served and walked with at Faith Action, stories of tremendous struggle in terms of the journey story, leaving one country, coming to another, and at the same time, the tremendous hope and courage and resilience that has occurred through that journey story. And so our 10 stories really capture all of that in the immigrant experience, and it's something we're privileged to see and experience every day at Faith Action.
And now how is this incorporating into the One City, One Book initiative?
I think every other year they do a One City, One Book project where the entire city will read a book. And this year, in the midst of our tremendous new diversity, they thought it was important and timely to do a book called Into the Beautiful North, about a young woman's journey from small town Mexico into the United States. And it's a compelling book full of sadness and humor and resilience and courage. And we knew that we had thousands of these stories right here in Greensboro to tell, some of the most incredible stories that each deserve their own movie. So at the least we could do is share these tremendous stories with our greater public at the Upstage Cabaret space at the Triad Stage.
And we've got one of those stories from a big town girl to the United States, about as big as it gets, Mexico, DF, Mexico City.
Yes, sir.
And Andy Mendez here to talk about it. First off, Andy, what do you do at Faith Action House?
A little bit of everything. I'm the administrative assistant, mm-hmm. and also starting the Latino outreach and education.
This project has a lot of relevance in your life. Could you describe your current family situation?
I'm the mother of a mixed status family. I'm the first action. My daughter is a U.S. citizen, born here, and my husband is an undocumented immigrant.
In addition to your activities at Faith Action, you've been a very vocal proponent for immigration reform, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your D.C. trip. Describe the dynamic, and what did you say to these people?
I just told them my story as an immigrant. I just told them why I was brought here and, you know, what it meant to me while they were waiting to take a decision if they're going to support or not immigration reform, how it was affecting me directly on my daily basis life, how it was affecting my husband and how it was affecting my daughter, which is a U.S. citizen here.
Could you share some of those stories with us? I mean, how does that status impact you on a daily basis?
Just the fact, since you wake up and you have to say goodbye to your husband because he has to go to work from 6 to 8 every day, you're afraid that he might be stopped. And because he doesn't have a driver's license, he might be deported as the hundreds of people that get deported every day. The fact of seeing my daughter graduating from pre-K, you know, it's something very simple, but it takes such emotional thorn on you that that you dream that one day she's going to graduate from college. And due to your situation, you know, you were not able. So it's a great moment as a mother, but as a human being, you know, you're like, a little ouchy there.
David, how does Out of the Shadows convey these sorts of stories?
These stories help people understand the desperate circumstances that many people flee, that it's oftentimes a matter of survival, not only just a shot at a better life, but legitimate survival, and that most people don't want to potentially overstay a visa or be seen as a problem. And I assure you, moms don't want to be potentially walking 3 days in the desert. And they're fleeing one traumatic situation and then having to go through a brand new traumatizing situation by crossing the desert and then living with that fear in the United States. I mean, those come across as very sad, sorrowful stories full of dramatic flavor. But what's remarkable is that in all of these stories, you get another side to see the courage and the hope and the resilience that's in the human spirit. That's what great drama's made of. Mano negra, clandestina,
peruano, clandestino. Put me in the audience.
Most people, if they went to high school, saw a production of Our Town. It was very bare, very simple. This is just a bare brick stage in the background with people getting up from a chair and telling a story, honestly. No thrills about it, no major set or movement. And these are immigrant actors themselves who have a very close connection to this issue. So we're not going with professional trained actors. We're going with people who know these stories, who have their own story to tell as well. Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos. 10 años
pasaron ya. Could we hear a monologue?
My name is Erendira Mendez, well known as Indy. Indy Mendez. I'm an immigrant myself from Mexico City. Been in the country 13 years. The daughter of two. I have a brother, a little younger brother, and we were brought here to reunite with my dad after finding out he had a job-related accident, which caused him to lose his leg. And as a family, we needed to be there. And after several attempts of trying to come to the country the correct way, we were in a desperate situation, and we decided to walk 3 days through the desert. A situation where it will scar you for life. It was so dark at night, you couldn't see your own hand. And it was so hot, and you quickly realized it was not a venture that you thought it was going to be. We made it to the country, and we adapted. We start feeling like we belong here. Of course, we went through the situation in high school, finding out that, you know, we didn't, what he meant not to have a social security. And my dad is the type of person that always, since we were younger, education is going to give you success in life. And that's why we came here, you know. He came to the country to give us that opportunity, you know, to provide money in our country, to give us a good education. Due to the situation we encountered ourselves, we came to the country, right? And that was his dream, you know. And within a week, he put us in school, you know. So education, it was really important. And now you're told you're not allowed to get education. And it was really traumatizing. I guess you come to the point of your life, you resign yourself to what's going on. And you just get waitress's job, every job is a decent job. But, you know, when you knew you had skills for more. My brother didn't took it as well. He was held up last week. And he went back 2 years ago because he wanted to study engineering, which was really expensive if he paid out-of-state tuition here. And he was just tired of being told, we don't want you here, you don't belong here. He was tired of getting paid minimum wage and being overworked as a cook, you know, and he knew he couldn't complain because what else could he do? So he left, and last week you get to that point that you want to be there for him. What if something happened to him? Something happened to him already, and you're not there. You cannot drop anything. I have my family here. I have my little one. If I go there, how can I help him if I don't have a job there? And this theater project, I think, is a great opportunity to people to hear the other side, to really understand it. Just to give that opportunity, you know, it's just a simple hello, how are you? Or even if you don't understand their English or accent, just make it an effort. It will make a big difference in someone else's life. Because, you know, they might have a rough morning, you know?
Just a quick note that on the way back from Washington, D.C., which was an incredible trip to see the potential of America through new immigrants' eyes, but the most meaningful part for me was on the ride home. It's a long, kind of boring ride at night, 6 hours. And we were just talking. I was the only white Caucasian citizen in the car and speak a little bit of Spanish, but not great. And so we were just chatting, and I was just saying, you know, what is it really going to take for legitimately strangers to become neighbors? Because most of us don't have a friend across those lines of differences. And so I just asked somebody, and I didn't get some kind of straight-up answer or theory or, you know, dissertation. This guy just said in the back seat, let me tell you a story. He said, when my sister and I had to walk across the desert, we came here, we moved to Reidsville, you know, a very small farming community way far away from downtown Greensboro. And they moved into this very small, predominantly white Caucasian farming community, this family from Mexico. And they put their child into school right away. I think he was in fourth grade or something like that. And they were having trouble understanding how to do his homework, how to help the child with the homework. So they went to their neighbor's home, this elderly white Caucasian farming couple, and knocked on the door and in kind of very broken English essentially said, would you at all be able to help my son with his math? And this elderly couple greeted them with a smile and invited them in. And despite the lack of language in common and culture in common, they used a lot of nonverbals, and they helped that child move forward in school. And the family from Mexico helped repay that family who was elderly with by mowing their lawn and making meals. And over time, you had this beautiful relationship start to develop where they're eating together, and they were starting to see one another not only as neighbors but as family. And they grew together and lived next to one another for years like that. And then this older gentleman got close to the end of his life, and he knew it was coming. And he called his Mexican neighbors over and said, you know, my life's coming to an end, but I want you all to take care of my wife after I pass on. And they ended up not only doing that, but actually carrying this man's casket at his funeral. And I bet you in the United States right now, those kind of stories are fairly rare. But they are out there. They just don't get told all that often. But those stories are gold. Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, te lo digo, compañero.
Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, que lo sepa el mundo entero. Faith Action International houses David Fracaro and Andy Mendez. Out of the Shadows, stories of hope and courage from our newest immigrant neighbors, Faith Action's theatrical performance of gripping tales of assimilation as told by local immigrants will take place November 15th and 16th at 8 o'clock and Sunday the 17th at 2 in the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage, 232 South Elm Street in Greensboro. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll be back with Cantus and a gripping holiday season theatrical and musical production like nothing you've ever experienced before. All Is Calm is coming up next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. All Is Calm, The Christmas Truce of 1914 by Peter Rothstein, with musical arrangements by Eric Lichty and Timothy Takash, is based on a true story that took place during the first winter of World War I. Next week, Minneapolis-based Theatre La Tida brings All Is Calm to the Triad. They'll be joined in performance by the internationally acclaimed men's vocal ensemble Cantus, with patriotic tunes, trench songs, medieval Scottish ballads, and holiday carols from England, Wales, France, and Germany. Music played a formative role in establishing the famous truce of 1914. Cantus tenor Aaron Humble and bass Chris Foss spoke with me by phone from their studio in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But now I know you're with me. You are the voice that whispers all I need. I know a please, a thank you, and a smile will take me far. One of the things you said on the homepage of your website, talking about this enjoyment of a piece as it kind of it changes over the years in your all's hands, I wonder if you could maybe describe how a piece evolves in your all's hands through rehearsals and repeated performances. You know, what sorts of things do you begin to hear and feel after the weeks of working through a piece?
Well, from a sort of a nuts and bolts perspective, there are always things that you can do to improve a piece. You know, if you are a carpenter or a baker or any sort of craftsman, you probably refine your technique over the years. You don't just repeat it over and over again and repeat the same mistakes. So there are things that we can fine-tune and sort of tweak in terms of ensemble, you know, making sure that everything is happening at exactly the same time, making sure that chords are lined up and exactly in tune, that every singer is singing the same shape of vowel. So those are things that are sort of an ongoing process that we do throughout a season, or you know, with a piece like All Is Calm, we've been doing it for 5 years. So that's definitely, you know, a time for all of those technical things to be addressed. But also, from an artistic standpoint, you make decisions. Every time you sing a phrase, you know, how are you going to sing it? Is the peak of the phrase the middle of it? Is it at the end of the phrase? Does it peak at the very beginning and taper to the end? Things like that that may seem subtle can have a huge impact on how the audience experiences the piece. And we're not afraid to mix it up. And if we would go back to our original recording and listen to it, we would maybe even be surprised how much we have changed and added additional nuances.
Chris, could you take that a step further in terms of listening? Say, we'll listen to a 5-year-old recording of something you've rehearsed and performed before, listening to it today with today's ears. What sorts of little distinctions would you make? Oh, we do it this way now, whereas before we didn't quite have that.
Having a relationship with a piece over 5 years is, I mean, it's kind of like a relationship that you'd have with a really good friend over 5 years. You start out, you might not know each other, but you find out things about each other, and then you become really familiar over the process of 5 years. But even if it's a really good friend, and in this case it is, it's an amazing piece of music that really touches people in some very valuable ways. You know, you're still surprised by certain things, and you still find out new things. You know, maybe there's a specific chord that you on a word that you haven't actually considered before, you know, and you want to bring that out, and that changes the meaning of a sentence. Or dynamically, you have this section that has always been sung loud for, you know, the last 5 years, but then, you know, maybe you get a little older, you get a little wiser, and you say, well, what would the sentence sound like if it was sung quietly and twice the amount of passion? And that it can sometimes change and increase and improve the message, I would say.
Hmm. The theatrical element is so huge in All Is Calm, at least very important here, it strikes me. I'm wondering what those early rehearsals were like for you all, and any surprises in the preparation for this piece. I guess we're going back 5 years now.
Well, it's really interesting to work with Peter Rothstein and Theatre La Tida. Being a chamber ensemble, you know, Cantus is completely artist-led. Theatre La Tida, they definitely have a spirit of collaboration in their productions, perhaps more than a traditional theatrical model where the director is calling, you know, 110% of the shots. We really got together and workshopped this as two organizations coming together.
And on calm evenings, the songs from one line would float to the trenches on the other side.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you
to just let listeners know a little bit more about All Is Calm, because it's such a unique, wonderful piece. It's just a fascinating period in our history with regard to the truce. A lot of people say it could never happen again.
The most amazing part about All Is Calm is that it actually happened, and it's a completely true story. What happened was the first winter in the war, everyone was had sort of dug into the trenches. You hear, you know, I'm sure you learned about in grade school about all the trench warfare that was happening in Western Europe. And so once both sides of the troops actually had started to dig in, and they realized that everyone thought that they would actually be home by Christmas, they would be back in England by Christmas, they would be back to their hometowns by Christmas, this was just going to be a short thing. And once they realized that they were going to be there for a while, then morale started to sink very low. And then eventually when it came Christmas time, people said, well, you know, why are we fighting when it's Christmas time? Here, this is where we're at. We need to celebrate this, you know, the wonderful sentiments of the season. So they started singing Christmas carols to each other from across the trenches in a bunch of different languages. And they actually left the trenches in a bunch of different places along the front and came out and they celebrated the Christmas season together, sometimes up to 2 weeks with each other, with the enemy troops. And then, you know, they eventually went back to their trenches and picked up their arms, and then they started fighting again. A lot of times, the troops actually had to be rotated off the line because they refused to fight each other again.
A sergeant major shouted, "Get down!" But we said, "Shut up, sergeant! It's Christmas time!"
About 90 to 95% of the actual spoken words are actually taken word for word from the letters that were written by soldiers from the pens of the people who were sitting in the trenches watching it happen.
Aaron, any thoughts along those lines in terms of what strikes you at a, you know, I guess a personal level?
Well, when I think about the truce, I think about the best of humanity coming through. This is a truce that was forged by the common man, by the lowest of the ranks in the armies, and it was the people at the top that were railing against it. And now, you know, in modern day, warfare is not a human-to-human event. Very often it's done remotely and by robots and machines. So it is pretty hard to imagine how this would ever be able to take place in modern times. And also the fact that these were countries at war, but they were also all from a Western European paradigm, you know, with, in many ways, a lot of cultural similarities. We don't have a lot of those similarities in our huge global society now, and I think that that is something that, you know, many people experience on a personal level when they've traveled to a place that seems strange and foreign. They can have a human experience with someone with whom they thought they had nothing in common. But we have to put ourselves out there to let that happen and not just sort of hide behind our own fear. You know, this is a really unique Christmas program. It's a Christmas program that talks about the best parts of humanity. And so much of the time, Christmas programming is light and maybe even saccharine. But this is not. And it's a different take and a refreshing look at our human experience for the holidays.
For a single night, no man's land was every man's land.
Cantu's vocal ensemble tenor Aaron Humble and bass Chris Voss. The Minneapolis-based Theatre La Teda and Cantu's will perform All Is Calm, The Christmas Truce of 1914 by Peter Rothstein on Thursday night, November 21st at 7:30 in Brendel Recital Hall at Wake Forest University. It's part of the Seacrest Performance Series, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. That's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And we'd all love to hear from you. Please send us your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. You'll find podcasts for this show and archived episodes on our website at wfdd.org. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.